The Tom Woods Show, episode 2326.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined today by Jack Lloyd, whose latest book is called A Vision for a Libertarian Future. Will not take you long to read it, but it'll recall us to some of the foundational principles that can often get lost amidst all the crazy headlines we see from day to day. So Jack, welcome to the show.
Hey Tom, thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. You know, what I was saying in introducing you, it really is true, and it speaks to the need for this particular episode and for your book, because these days, well, probably at least starting with COVID, there have been so many crazy things going on that it's very easy to become reactive and just be responding to the headlines or responding to the latest crazy thing, and then forget about the big picture of what it is that we're striving for. What does the world we want to see look like? How do we move toward that? It's important to talk about that from time to time. Otherwise, it's all going to be, as I say, just nothing but reacting to oddball events. And there is merit in that, but it can be very distracting to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly why I wrote this book, is because so many people hear about libertarian principles and they kind of get a sense of it and they get some issue advocacy things going, like, oh, maybe we should end the war on drugs, or yeah, we got to do something about the Fed. But very few people have a cohesive, coherent, cogent advocacy that kind of unifies everything together in a way that they can consistently and practically apply those principles in action and general advocacy. So that's why I put this book together, because I saw so many people not able to articulate that in a succinct way. And I think that more than ever, it's ripe, because there's so many people who are seeing the message of liberty now that it's become kind of mainstreamed, thanks to, in part, as you just mentioned, all the lockdowns and the shutdowns and the nonsense with the government over COVID, and how much they have tried to manipulate people into having a totalitarian police state. And a lot of people are now primed and ready to hear the message, because they saw just how bad things can be, whether it's the riots and police not actually doing anything and saying you're just on your own, you know, the governors and the mayors just letting things go on, to the government trying to force medical experimentation on people. People are starting to wake up, and now they need that type of vision to say, okay, how do we have this never happen again? How do we actually advocate for things that decentralize the state power that has grown so enormous that it's really just unfathomable how much they have intervened in our lives and how much they rationalize controlling us.
I should say that it's necessary for people to have an open mind before they read a book like this, because, or listen to a conversation like this one, because you and I will say very matter-of-factly things that will sound shocking to a lot of people. But I would just caution people just to stop and realize that the way out of the present situation is not going to involve creating a system that looks 12% different from the one we have now, or just changing 2% of things on the margins. It's going to have to be changed root and branch. And that is going to involve proposals you've never thought of, or things that sound utopian or whatever. But that's natural. We're so far from where we want to be, and we're so far from the humane society we want, that the measures we recommend will indeed sound oddball. But what we need to understand is that the real oddballs are the people running the show now. What's really oddball is the present system.
Absolutely. And I think that what I tried to do too with my book is that I tried to make it relatable to people in the real world. And a big part of what I've done in my own work in waking people up to the principles of liberty is relating to real world things that you can point to, actual policies, actual things existing around the world where you have comparatives. And when people can see comparatives and see them work out in the real world, it becomes a lot more easy to relate to what libertarians are actually advocating for. And one of those chief ones I talk about in my book is specifically moving toward a lotto scratch-off funding system with the government. And this really is not something that is new or even shocking. In fact, the colonies were largely funded, a lot of what they did, through lotteries. Even Jamestown, that colony, was specifically helped along with a lottery, and many different types of structures were built in the colonies, from roads to other types of, I guess you could say, bridges and things like that, were built using lotto revenue. And this may be something that you even know about with Harvard. They actually used lotteries themselves to fund some of their halls. Like Stoughton Hall was actually funded with a lottery. So this idea of using lotteries is not strange. It's very historical in terms of American experience. And today, we see that rampantly. I mean, the Florida Lotto itself has raised over $31 billion in 29 years. There's tribal gaming, which they use that for their infrastructure. They do road construction. They do water treatment. They even do sometimes per capita money to some of the native residents through tribal gaming. So these are not things that are just brand new and completely unheard of, and you can't even imagine how it would work. These are things that are long-standing American traditions that still to this day are used as alternative non-coercive funding structures. And why it's so important to have that is because you actually have choice in the matter. If you don't wish to play lottery for any reason, whether it's just personal preference or a religious thing, you don't have to, and that's fine. And then the people who do want to play can play, and there's novelty in that. There's an enjoyment of people seeing, oh, okay, who's going to win, and how close do I get? And then, you know, you played a game, and hey, at worst, you lose, and it helps actually build the roads, you know? So I think that these types of things are really practical in terms of advocacy and transition, because it's not something that we have to just have conjectures about or hypotheticals about. It's real, it exists, and all it needs is a little bit of tuning to change to make that the mainstay, instead of taxes through all the different various taxes we're being taxed by, the norm, and then, oh, okay, we have some lotteries and that's the supplemental. I think that a shift in thinking, moving back to this historical tradition that Americans experience in terms of government being funded through voluntary means, is actually a major political solution. Even if it's not perfect, it is certainly an ethical step forward in incrementalism. And so that's just one example among many that I use in my book to help people see the ways that we can move toward ending the government's mass violence through theft, war, and conscription, which is really what makes states states, those elements that makes states unique forms of violence as opposed to your common robber or mugger. So that's really just what I want to do, is help people wrap their minds around these ideas and connect it to the real world in a way that makes sense, that they can say, oh, you know what? I really should support something like that. That's a much better way to do things without everything being plunged into chaos.
Just yesterday, I had Corey DeAngelis and Connor Boyack on, and of course, we talked about education. So you might think I would glide past that in this episode, but I don't want to, because I like what you have to say in your chapter on education. In particular, I'm interested in your approach to the student loan question. But before we get to that student loan question, I mean, you've been an educator yourself for some time, and so I think you have a unique take on this. I think you would be the sort of person to say that the problem with the current approach we have to education is not exclusively that it's mostly a government monopoly. It's not just that we want to remove the monopoly, but then just keep it exactly the way it is. I think your view is that there's also something wrong with the way it is, monopoly or not. So what is your basic critique of the way we educate most kids, and how would that change, do you think, in a freer society?
Sure. So just a little background about me, just so people have a context to this. So my father was a 32-year New York City school teacher. So I come from a background of having his experience and seeing that in person, being a school teacher in New York City in some rough places. And then I myself have engaged in the schooling space quite a bit, between having been a criminal defense lawyer for juveniles, having been a public school teacher at a, you could say, an 8A, which is the largest sized high school, and a K-8 charter school. And I also did substitute teaching, tutoring, and had a tutoring company for a time. So I've worked with young people in a variety of contexts and have gotten to actually see what it's like firsthand, both having been a student, having been with students in their homes, having been with students in a public school setting and in private tutoring settings, and so on and so forth. So I've kind of seen the full gamut, including, of course, kids in juvenile detention in orange jumpsuits doing the school thing. And a part of that experience that has informed me about what is wrong with it is just seeing how many young people are disheartened and discarded by the process. Because in the compulsory schooling paradigm, what you really have is a system that rewards young people who are most able and are most willing to comply with the dictates of teachers. And this might seem difficult at first to kind of wrap your mind around, but just remember, young kids, especially when you're talking about elementary to middle school, they don't really have much choice in their life. They're there because their parents, you know, send them to the school of wherever it is they want them to go, whether it's by, you know, private or public, but they're sending them there not because they necessarily chose that. So they're in this situation where this regime is put upon them and they are told they have to comply and conform. And if they don't, they're going to be given grades like the A to F grades that most people are familiar with. And these types of grades are stigmas for whether or not you are able to and are willing to comply with the teacher's directions. And the reason why that is that even if you know the material, right, you could be a very bright person and you could ace the tests every time and ace the quizzes. If you don't do your homework because you're like, this is boring, this is dull, I don't want to do this, you're going to be given an F on those materials and your grade will come down, right? So ultimately, it's not really your knowledge. It's just how much are you willing to do and perform within the window in which they're going to test you, quiz you, and mark you. And while some people like to think that, this is a measure of your true knowledge and intelligence, reality is it's a true measure of obedience and a willingness and ability to conform to that. And it's very unfortunate because every child is different and every kid is going to learn at different intervals within their life. And we wouldn't look at a child who happens to walk a little bit later and say, there's something wrong with them because they started walking a little later or they maybe walked a little earlier. You would say, kids, they learn different paces and when they're ready, they're ready. But when people try to force children into a one-size-fits-all policy where they must read at a certain level at a certain year by everybody's limited one-year window, you're now putting on these shaming expectations on the kids that end up causing them to feel worthless and incompetent, when in reality, they just may not be ready for that yet. And that's really unfortunate because what you have by the time you're done with the schooling process is that by your senior year, those who are most rewarded are those who are most able and willing to conform, and they got the benefits and the social privileges of that conformity being in honors classes, not getting denied certain trips, having a little bit more favoritism typically from teachers. And those who weren't able to, for whatever reason, and I've seen this firsthand being a teacher, you can have kids who their older sibling is jumping on them in the middle of the night because they have a problem with type of dysfunctional autism. You have situations with divorce, right? And that affects how a kid performs. So there's death or there's sickness or whatever it is. But that doesn't matter when it comes to grades. The grades come and the curriculum keeps going no matter what's going on in a child's life. That's out of their control. So unfortunately, this ends up favoring those who have the most support and, of course, the most resources to help them most typically. And it ends up hurting those who, for whatever reason, are not able and willing to conform. And so my approach in this book is I talk about this new wave of education that rejects this one-size-fits-all policy called unschooling or self-directed education. And this type of learning is not something that is just totally new and, you know, never been done before. In fact, there is this school called the Sudbury Valley School in Framingham, Massachusetts. It's been around since 1968, where young people are free to learn as they wish. They choose their own topics generally. And the adults there act as facilitators instead of performance judges. And what this means is that young people choose to read or write or engage in the culture, and they pick up the skills of the culture using the tools of the culture as is relevant to them. And the learning there is much deeper because when you actually are wanting to learn about something, you're really engaged in it, it sticks around much more than just, I got to memorize these five facts about what happened 2,000 years ago, and then, I'm going to forget it in 2 weeks, right? So the learning that takes place there is much more meaningful. It's much more deep. And because of that, young people end up being motivated. They have intrinsic motivation to learn and to do and to experience and explore, including up to going to college and university, and even Ivy League schools from this institution, because they had the freedom to choose in learning. They had the freedom to actually explore their interests, find what made sense for them, and then truly pursue that with adults there saying, this is what you like to do. Okay, well, let's get you resources and help you. And that doesn't mean that there's no ever any use of textbooks or even a formal class. It just means that young people being free to choose, they have the opportunity to choose what it is that they like, helps reinforce their own natural love of learning. And instead of this turning off and this resentment of learning, right? You get math anxiety or reading anxiety. I mean, there's so many people who stop reading books after they leave high school. It's like, I'm done. Or college, they're like, I'm done. But young people who are free don't have that fear. They don't have the stigmatization that learning is a chore, that learning is, you know, force and coercion, and that, oh, you're just going to be stupid. You'll work at McDonald's, maybe, you know, if you're lucky, if you don't do this. So I promote that in my book as a means of exiting the schooling paradigm, in addition to talk about some structures and funding changes. But that is something that is very near and dear to my heart, is promoting unschooling and self-directed education and helping people see that there is an ethical path forward for young people where, again, they're not going to end up becoming derelicts and homeless and unable to do anything when adults change their mindsets and no longer live in fear and rule by fear that their children are just going to become broke and homeless just because they didn't happen to learn reading at this level by the age 7, you know. So,
well, in addition to that, and I actually had somebody from the Sudbury School on the show years ago, so I'm familiar with them. Can you say something about your take on how to handle the student loan issue? Because I've never heard it handled quite the way you propose.
Absolutely. So in my book, I talk about the student loan issue because that's a big issue, right? We're talking $1.5 trillion of debt. It seems like this is never going to go away. Most young people feel desperate about it, thinking, what am I going to do? I mean, this economy is terrible. Prices keep going up because of inflation. So understandably, there is going to be major economic ramifications if this isn't somehow resolved. And I also do feel for young people in this way because many times they are pushed to take on this debt right after they just had to ask to go to the bathroom, right? And so I get that. It's very personal to me that it's very tough for these young people told, oh, you need to go to college. And okay, well, you need to go to debt. And then the adults around them now have this terrible economy to be coming into. So I suggest that because the U.S. government has some 640 million acres in their possession, that's the federal government, that it could be possible for a type of restitution paradigm where people are given a restitution in an acre form, that is, you know, acre land plot, and those who had student loans could forego that restitution by basically saying, okay, in exchange for me not having my student loan, for that being forgiven, I give up my restitution this 1 acre. So what I try to do here is heuristically balance the 43 million student loan borrowers against a restitution system that doesn't unfairly benefit those who have student loans and them getting forgiveness. Instead, it gives the opportunity for those who did pay back diligently to get restitution in a land grant. And for those who are like, this loan is too much for me, I'll forego my restitution in the land, that gives them an opportunity to get out of that debt and to move on and move forward. And I mentioned there too how there's an auction process with some of the government assets and the land as well. And that's a whole complex thing, but it's a way to think about how to deal with these types of debt issues and forgiveness, again, with privatization in mind. Here, as Austria's libertarians, individual discrete private property ownership is key, but also, you know, not unfavorably benefiting one group versus another in terms of those who borrowed, right? We want to make sure that everybody who was responsible and paid back on time for whatever reason, that they are given restitution and not unfairly treated.
Just to clarify, even though I asked for that very specific issue, people should be aware that you cover a very broad array of topics in here. So we're talking everything from national defense to law, policing, money, taxation, the Federal Reserve. We've already talked about education. And toward the end, I just can't help bringing this up, right? I can't help bringing it up. And you must have realized this was coming when you wrote a book on this subject. We have to say a few words about the roads. We have to. Because it is incredible to me how little creativity people have. You look at the sophisticated ways we handle all kinds of difficult problems in the private sector. And I mean, like, for example, just the very existence of credit cards. I bet most people wouldn't have thought of that even as an option. But credit cards, when used correctly, facilitate transactions with great convenience and benefits for all concerned. But I could imagine people thinking we needed to impose them or invent them or whatever, but they just emerged spontaneously. So there are all these, and we're talking about, we've got online networks around the world that instantaneously make sure you have enough credit to make the purchase. So we can accomplish all that, but we can't lay down some tar from a guy's house to a store, you know, unless we're cracked over the head with a baseball bat. I just feel like we could probably figure something out. Like, even without any ideas of my own, my gut instinct would be humanity would figure something out. But that's not a satisfying enough answer for some people. So what is your thinking on this?
Yeah, I definitely understand where people come from about, you know, we'll build the roads. Because as I say in my book, roads are everywhere, right? It's what connects us to other people. It's what lets people travel. It's what lets people trade. So I get it. Roads are present. They're everywhere. You're thinking about it all the time. You're on the road. I get it. But the idea that roads is a difficult issue is, as you said, it's not really too difficult. We already have roads. So the question of, oh, who will build the roads is, to me, not the right framing. The roads already are here. We have them abundantly. So the question is just, how is that funded and how is that paid for? And how are future roads or future modes of transport taken care of? And so to me, the road situation moving toward more of a market-based means for funding that, I think, is a wise idea. And I mentioned in there about how the government can shift to certain types of advertising, revenue forms, as well as using paid express lanes and so on to subsidize free lanes with higher paid express lanes and so on and so forth. It's not really all that strange. I mean, this already exists. And again, one of the key things I try to harp on in my book is that when I talk about these things, I'm not talking about making up something that is never been done before. A lot of these things are already just out there. It's not even weird or anything. People do it without even thinking about it. But relying on that as the main instead of the supplementary is the key. And I think that when we start moving in that direction and people begin to envision how that could be done, I think that it's going to make a lot more sense to people in this type of new paradigm of thinking about, oh, okay, roads can be maintained and funded through a variety of ways. You don't necessarily need taxes for that. You can use lottery funding. You can use advertising funding. You can use paid express lanes. And on top of that, when people are interested in new construction, just like there was historically, I do mention this in my book that in early America, of course, there was private road construction. People used corporations that would build turnpikes and toll roads, and people would have shares in these things. Even if the profits were marginal or very little, just the excitement of having a new way to get around and to get to here and there in other states faster was just exciting. And businesses wanted to invest in that because, like, hey, we're going to get more traffic, right? If you have a new type of road that's being built that lets more people come to your part of town, that's exciting. It means, hey, more potential customers. So these incentives exist. They've existed for a long time. There's nothing new to them. It's just a matter of reframing what we're thinking about. And as a note too, as well in this, the roads, I think, are even going to become less and less of a thing as we move toward a free market in transportation. For so long, people have wanted to do more aerial things. And the FAA even recently shut down an Uber for planes. We would have had a revolution in private air transport, people sharing small plane, mid-sized plane rides. And they shut that down. And now you're having around the world a new revolution in drone technology with people using drones that are actually autonomous and moving people to and fro, you know, by computer. That is going to revolutionize things too. So it's a matter of saying, hey, there are even better things. You're not even going to care so much about the roads if you just free the market a little bit long enough for people to actually come with solutions that make the roads seem like riding the horse and buggy. It will seem like antiquated technology compared to what's possible if people are free to innovate.
Hey, everybody, quick message from our sponsor, CrowdHealth. Our friend Gene Epstein has a special term he uses to refer to what happens when cronyism makes its way into the capitalist system. He calls it crapitalism, and that is a great word to describe the current American healthcare system. When you pay monthly bills other than healthcare, you know exactly what you're getting. So your rent, your car payment, your groceries, whatever. Healthcare is just the opposite, not transparent at all. The plans can be confusing and expensive. You don't know what they're going to honor, what they're not, and then using your benefits can be a big pain in the neck. Well, CrowdHealth is going to fix all that. It is going to reverse the perverse incentives that put us in this situation to begin with. As a member, you get a personal care advocate to help navigate the complexities of health events. That advocate will even negotiate bills on your behalf. They'll be with you every step of the way and could save you thousands in health bills in the process. $40 of your $175 monthly payment helps pay for your care advocate, telemedicine services, discounted prescriptions, and other tools to get you the best care at an affordable price. And the remainder of the monthly payment goes into a CrowdHealth account that you own so you can help others in the crowd pay for their medical expenses as well. Experience healthcare freedom with CrowdHealth. Visit joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get your first 3 months for just $99 per month. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. Toward the beginning, you talk about taxation and you talk about if we were to lower and or abolish certain taxes, here's how we ought to do it. And this should be the top priority, then this, then this. And that's all well and good. We need to have that. But as you know, the main obstacle to getting rid of these things is not that we haven't thought through the right order in which to do it. The main reason is there are vast, vast interest groups that rely on the stream of income they receive through these taxes. And that is the tough sell here, because there are some people, well, in a way, it calls to mind that old saying that it's very difficult to get somebody to understand something when he earns his salary on the basis of not understanding it. Well, likewise, let's say the recipients of the tax money are going to be a hard sell on this. So that's the thing that's getting in the way, is that we have the poor, we have the rich, we have all different groups. We have the military, groups that are more powerful than you and I combined, Jack, these groups. And so before we can even get to the point where we could seriously have a 10-year plan of gradually lowering taxes, we have an almost seemingly insurmountable task ahead of us involving changing minds.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you there that there are obviously the interests of those who benefit from the theft and distribution scheme of the government, and there's those who, for malicious reasons, don't ever want to see that go away. Of course, absolutely. So the big part of why I have this kind of framing is to give people that vision for cultural change. I am a firm believer that politics is a bit downwind from culture, and that there are many competing interests at play, even among governments. So in this, we're trying to get people along this vision to as best degree as possible, because the more that people buy into it and the more that people think about how to consistently reduce the size, scope, and power of the state, the more that people can take principled action toward those ends. And I think that we're actually seeing these types of things come to a head naturally, because when the government gets to a point where their spending and their thefts and their distributions and their tyrannies are so great, people are going to crave change. And there are people in the state and within different sovereignties that are going to see this as an opportunity to step up and offer change and offer a solution. And I think that you can actually see this kind of manifest as well with things like legal tender states, right? With Utah, Arkansas, Wyoming, Oklahoma, and United Precious Metals Association, right, in the Utah Goldback, with people starting to say, whoa, the government is printing way too much money right now, or currency, I should say, and they are destroying what value we have. We need to do something about this. And on top of that, you have the Great Reset and these central bank digital currencies. So there is a huge threat against people's livelihoods, and many people, even at the state government level, are recognizing these problems. And so it's a holistic view of multiple means of attack on state centralized power. And while this vision may seem very utopian in a sense that it seems daunting, I don't believe that the psychological element of the vision is itself utopian. I think it's just the principled approach that if we just keep staying focused on this, you get focused action that does actually push back against the federal tyranny that we see today. And I think you touch on that very well too when it comes to your topics of nullification, secession. So even things like legal tender laws, getting rid of tax on gold and silver, helping people trade outside of that fiat or digital system with all the extra, I can't even begin to count how many made up digital dollars there are. I mean, it's got to be something 60 plus trillion or something when you factor in everything, derivatives and all the banks after 2020 having no restrictions on their even their fractional reserve aspect, you know, that got lifted. So people are going to face that tough turning point where it doesn't really matter anymore. You know, you could talk about this and be like, oh, you know, I don't think that'll happen. But it's like, yeah, well, what happens when the government destroys what you have left, right? Then you do have that pain that supersedes that resistance to change. And I think that that is absolutely critical for anything in terms of change. When you think about how people start to move away from what they've been programmed to believe, they need that pain. They need the realization of pain from poor state policy in order to get motivated for change. I think the greatest evidence of that just recently is, again, the 2020 lockdown, shutdowns, all that stuff. People woke up. they realize how bad things can be with what the government's powers are and what they're actually doing. And a large contingency of people came together and rallied together and started to push back against that and also wake others up. So I think that's kind of where we're at in terms of this, is that regardless of whether this vision I put down in the book is actually achievable within our lifetimes or whether it is something that can be done in the exact order, to me, it matters less than getting people to be consistent, principled, and to think outside the state. And if you can get yourself to think outside the state, think outside of state solutions, you've already done half the battle, because now you're not going to compromise when you're different pet issue comes up. You're going to recognize the manipulations. You're going to recognize the media lies. And you're going to say, no, I'm not going to give into more state power. The solution is less government, not more government. And I think that that is truly key for a sustainable libertarian future. It's not sustainable to just have a couple issues here and there. You're like, oh, you know, I'm a libertarian. No, you really need those principles of property rights and self-ownership grounded through and through. And I do that in my prequel to this book, The Definitive Guide to Libertarian Voluntarism. I kind of laid down those foundational principles that buttress my sequel to that, A Vision for a Libertarian Future. So I do recommend both as part of this holistic thinking.
Well, I'll have them linked at tomwoods.com/2326. I want to bring up one other thing. We've seen since the rise of Donald Trump politically, the phenomenon of right-wing populism. And there are some benefits to it in the sense that sometimes it's directed at the right bad guys. So sometimes the movement gets very upset at the military-industrial complex. I think that's great. Good. Direct their anger there. Sometimes they even get upset at the Federal Reserve. Great. Excellent. Sometimes they get upset at Dr. Fauci. Tremendous. That would never have happened under a Mitt Romney. Now, of course, Trump is the one who brought Fauci in to direct the whole thing, but he eventually turned on Fauci in a way that I don't think the regular Republican Party ever would have. So there have been some good things. But on the other hand, then sometimes it's turned against the wrong thing. So I don't want to be lectured to about how we need to go to war with China or this. Some of these things they get sidetracked on. I don't really want that. But the other side of this right-wing populism thing is that the politicians associated with it appear to have made their peace with the huge welfare spending programs, and particularly Social Security and Medicare. And I know it sounds heartless to say that something needs to be done about these programs, but if you've looked at the numbers of where these things are going in the future, there's no way it can be sustained. So it's not evil to point that out. That's just a fact. Facts don't care about your feelings. Well, this is a fact that doesn't care about your feelings. But because the movement is populist, it doesn't go right at programs that its own constituency likes. And its own constituency is very much at peace with those programs. But those programs can't possibly persist given all the money they're going to require in the future and how little there will be in reality. So you here, again, take a very radical libertarian approach to these sorts of questions. But the issue is, it just seems like a loser rhetorically to say, yeah, we really, really need to go after Medicare. That just seems like a loser. So how do you mitigate that?
Absolutely. So when it comes to those points, absolutely salient about that with the inevitable collapse of these funding structures. As you said, it's mathematically impossible to sustain the number of beneficiaries. The amount of benefits far outweighs what can actually be gained from taking everybody's money, even if they stole everybody's wealth, right? And they just tax everybody 100%. It's just astronomical what these benefits are supposed to pay out in the future. So that obviously couched on its own, we need to look at the fundamental problems of why there are all these distortions in retirement and healthcare and taking care of people and so on and so forth. And I do touch on this in my book. I do touch on how we have an incredibly destructive healthcare system with how things have been manipulated between the tax incentives with, you know, employers providing health services, you know, healthcare through their businesses, with banning interstate insurance plans and so on and so forth, and trying to push more and more people to get insurance for things that don't even need insurance. If you know you're going to have a regular checkup, that's predictable, right? You know that's going to come up. You know that you're going to have to pay for it. And now you're just adding on a middle person who's going to just take more money and then maybe pay the doctor 6 months later. So I talk about a lot of these things where there is a huge amount of savings to be had in reforming all these different types of programs by moving it toward market-based means, and also in a transition, supplementing that with some restitution from what I talk about is the auction of certain federal lands and assets that then goes to people in this transition. So I kind of bridge that gap of concern by showing how the government could, in effect, move away from these regulations that prevent people from getting affordable health care, because obviously that's a big part of this, is the cost itself. And I even touch on a personal note about how when I recently went to a doctor's visit, I got a prescription, and that prescription, they said it would be $30. And I said, well, I'm just paying out of pocket. And they said, oh, well, then it's only 10. And I'm like, what? So I save 66% because I just pay directly. I mean, it's just all these types of examples can really drive at how these systems that the government has in the centralization, the bureaucracy, completely waste billions of dollars that absolutely is unnecessary to do in the first place. And I do touch on also, in addition to that, the fact that American charitable giving is enormous in the first place. I mean, we're talking near $500 billion, and that is with tax incentives, but there's been plenty of study research done this, that even if you cut that, Americans definitely give to charitable causes and are more so discerning to do so because it's their money and they're vetting the situation. And I think that in a free market paradigm, you're actually going to have better incentives of people trying to stay healthy. You're going to have better and cheaper options in terms of people being able to afford direct care. And that in turn frees up the needed charitable help and aid that is so often missed in this so that people don't even think about that. And right now we have oodles of charitable care with not-for-profit clinics and hospitals that do write-offs and so on and so forth. But think that that exists even with all this theft and all this tyranny, and yet people are still charitable. They're still St. Jude's. There's still many different types of clinics and aides and doctors who will give the occasional client who's indigent a pass just because they, you know, need help. It is just not that hard to imagine, knowing what we know about charitable giving and about the bloat of the state, that this can actually be accomplished. And in a way that makes everybody happier because they're not busy dealing with a bunch of bureaucracy and chasing down payments and paying extra for people who are just pushing paper. So I think that's really what I like to focus on when it comes to those things, you know, with like Medicare, Medicaid, retirement things. And I try to point people to the fact that the government is making it so incredibly expensive and distorting the incentives so great that we have more unhealthy people than there would be. We have more needs of self-chosen harms than there would be. And we have so much wasted resources in just paperwork and bureaucracy and government adding on more and more unnecessary clinical staff just to deal with all the different types of government filings and HIPAA and so on and so forth. So I think that's really what we need to get at, is helping people recognize that the prosperity and the flourishing that takes place from getting government out of the way, it's going to be so much better than you can possibly imagine, and then some.
Well, the book, once again, is A Vision for a Libertarian Future by our friend Jack Lloyd. I will have that and his previous title, as I say, linked on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2326. I urge you to read it. And in the meantime, also, is there any other website or anything else you'd like to promote so people can follow you?
Sure, yeah. Right now, it's currently in a remaster, but I do also produce Voluntarius, the comic series at V is in Victory, OLCOMIC, that's ballcomic.com. And I produce content for a variety of different outlets, from The Philosopher, The Honest Teacher, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I do music. And I mean, I think some people heard Tom Wood's house maybe back in the day.
If you were at the 2000th episode, the live version began with the song that you and your wife wrote, your now wife wrote about, yeah, what I love that it was kind of the lyrics are kind of like, what you envision might actually take place at Tom Woods' house, like Bob Murphy's there and all these people and we're having great conversation, whatever. And actually what happens at the house is extremely mundane. You know, it's just the, you know, the wife and the kids and we're making dinner and going to sleep and that's it. I mean, that really is about it. But I loved how glamorous my house suddenly seemed thanks to your video.
I appreciate it. It's the least I can do. I mean, I think one of the rare things is that, and I think this is very special, you've been to my wedding and I've been to your wedding. I think that's kind of rare and unique. So I just have to give a little shout out there.
And certainly among podcast guests, that is very rare.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not sure I have another. Well, obviously your wife, I've been to her wedding, but that's it's obvious.
I hope so.
But yeah, that's a great point. I think you may be the only guest I can say that of. We've been to each other's weddings. Anyway, all right, we're getting a little bit sidetracked here. If there's anything else you want me to link to, just send it to me and I will put it up there at tomwoods.com/2326. So thanks so much, Jack.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tom. Thanks for all you do too.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.